You're listening to Stages, and this week we're talking with Lee Lewis. She was the head of Griffin Theatre for over 6 years, and she's headed up to the warmer country of Queensland, or the state of Queensland. She has so many directorial successes under her belt for Griffin, The Bleeding Tree, Splinter, Prima Facie, and we spoke with the lovely Sheridan Harbridge last week, The Almighty Sometimes, Kill Climate Deniers. She's done work for Bell Shakespeare, The School of Wives, Twelfth Night, Belvoir, STC. She took Rupert from Melbourne Theatre Company over to DC. I can't go on, otherwise we'll be here all day. She's on the line to have a chat with us. Thanks for joining us, Lee Lewis.
Hello, Regina. Thank you for having me. It's been quite a crazy time.
It is. It is, and not so great for theatre, obviously.
It's been quite devastating, but and in unimagined ways. So, yeah, we're all, what it has done is bring the theatre community closer together. And broken down a lot of the barriers that were that had been built up over a long period of time, because we are all in this boat together, and we're paddling as fast as we can to see if we can actually stay afloat until we can open the theatres again, and we can bit by bit invite audiences back into our spaces. But I've got all of the scary analogies. It's like a high wire act at the moment. The people's lives at stake, you know. And I part of my job is to actually keep a sort of sense of optimism for the company and for the wider community. So I've kind of found a tone that is kind of upbeat, but I find myself saying horrific things with this upbeat voice. And I'm like, okay, what's the right way to talk about this? Something is off.
Before we jump into where things are at now, tell us a little bit about, you know, where you're from.
Oh, good heavens. Well, I actually began life in Chicago, believe it or not. My parents had moved to America as students, and I was born there. And then they moved us back to Africa, which is where they were from. So it was Rhodesia, and there was a civil war going on. And after their time in Chicago, surrounded by, you know, the energy of Martin Luther King and, you know, women's liberation, they couldn't live back in the politics of Africa. So they decided to move their kids to Australia, and I moved to Goulburn, which is in regional New South Wales.
I really did feel a long way away from the rest of the world, and I couldn't wait to leave Goulburn.
it was
a terrible place that my parents had dragged me to, away from family, all of this stuff. I couldn't wait to leave. And when I did, I ran as fast as I could and ended up spending 10 years in New York. And then had the, you know, kind of great good fortune to fall in love with an Australian from Lithgow, of all places, and moved back to Australia. He's a photographer, and we had a big conversation about the work that we wanted to make in our life. And after living in the States for 10 years, which, you know, was nominally where I was from, I realized how Australian I was, because I didn't believe in the American dream, which was, you know, the self-made man, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you know, the exceptionalism and the leaving everybody else in your wake, you know, the way they don't believe in taking care of the most vulnerable in their society, which is what we're seeing at the moment. You know, the country torn about apart by the lack of health care and the very real fear of dying poor and old in that country with absolutely no support. And I realized I didn't believe in that. I was actually Australian to my core in believing we should be taking care of our people. And so I realized as an artist I didn't want to make work that supported that status quo there. And we had a huge conversation, as serious 20-somethings will do. And we decided to make our work here in Australia. So we moved back here, and I sort of started again.
So you went from Goulburn to New York. Is that when you started studying acting?
Yeah, I did my master's in acting at Columbia. And then I stayed working from school. I was fortunate enough to be cast in a Julie Taymor production while I was still at school. Mm-hmm. So I started working on a production of hers called The Green Bird. And that was in my third year at Columbia. And I just kind of kept working from there. There were amazing teachers at Columbia, and I got to keep working with them once I graduated. And so I had a
a lovely time working as an actor in New York. I was very independent, and there were some amazing directors that I got to work for, and I had a cohort of friends that we were making theatre with, and I gradually in my head I started kind of being the outside eye. I wasn't a director back then, but I was starting to evolve into that thought. You know, you start getting, and I see it actually happening in some actors. You can see it now that I'm a director. I sit there and I kind of go, there are actors who are interested in more than just the being or the character that they're bringing to life. They're looking around them and they're looking at the whole, and they're craving more engagement with the whole story, not just the one character. And that's what started to happen to me. And when I came back to Australia, there wasn't as much work as an actor. And so I started directing more.
Do you miss acting?
No, I don't, because I was craving the bigger picture. I didn't want to play one character. I wanted to play more characters. I wanted to be across the whole thing, and I wanted to make decisions about how that was created for the audience. You know, I started to have that impulse and just started following that down. And after two or three years of directing, my dad said, "Do you think you'll ever act again?" I said, "No, Dad, I think I'm a director." He said, "Oh, thank God. Took you long enough to figure it out."
He knew.
So I used to write and direct plays and at school and all that sort of stuff. And he reminded me of that. And I was like, oh, I suppose I was. I didn't know. I'd never, for some reason, and I think about this a lot with young women, the first female director I ran into, I'd ever met, was Anne Bogart at Columbia. And Anne's extraordinary in the scheme of the world. So as a first one, that was a pretty good one, I have to say. And I don't know that I'd realized that was actually possible. I just hadn't gone, my brain hadn't gone there, even though I'd been doing it. We see actors, and so if we want to be in theatre, that seems to be the obvious channel. And if you don't want to be an actor, you think you don't want to be in theatre. But
As a woman,
yeah.
Well, that's certainly changed now, hasn't it?
It has changed. And I kind of go, and it's interesting for me, I saw what Anne was doing, and it wasn't like, oh, I can do that. It wasn't an automatic thing, but the possibility opened up. So when actual work possibilities open up, I didn't think, oh, I can't do that. I knew I could. I could start. I could try. And I'm conscious of that even now. There are actors who I work for who've never had a female director. I don't think of myself as a female director. I just go in and direct. But I can feel them going, oh, right, okay. And sometimes I'm curious as to whether it's different, but I kind of don't care. It is what it is now.
So was there a moment that must have been a defining moment for you to make that decision to come back to Australia, because it's such a romantic ideal to like live and act in New York, and maybe not now, but you know, at that time, I suppose, like what was that? No, we're going back. Like what was that conversation that you had with your now husband partner at the time?
It was about where do we want to make our work in the world, and because as a person working in the arts, you know this, your work goes to contribute to the building of a country. You know, the culture of a country is actually its expression of what it deeply believes. And if you're working for a system you don't believe in, your work is going to prop that up. And unless you're working as a radical political artist working against the system you're in, and that's not the kind of work that I actually do. I want to comment on the society we're in, but I don't want to destroy it. I want to build.
Influence it.
Grow it.
Yeah, influence and grow it and question it, but I don't want to tear it all down. And so I'd had to be with some basic material that I believed in, and I do believe in that. You know, I think we're losing bits of it, and I'm desperately trying to help make work that can make people believe in it. But that sense of egalitarianism, actual egalitarianism, we've had the word for a long time.
Rather than tokenism as well.
Yeah, we've had the word, and maybe it was that once. But, you know, when it comes to actual equality, no. And I think putting up stories that actually do celebrate actual equality in different ways in our society, actually believing in access, that our best work should be available to all people. So we need to find ways that we don't financially shut people out, that we don't shut people out on education ways. I love that there is still a connection between the arts and education and government here, that there are politicians that will sit in our audiences for new plays and listen to what playwrights are writing. And I take that responsibility really seriously, that if they're giving us 2 hours of their time, what have we got to say to them? Use the opportunity. And again, it's not necessarily about in-your-face politics, but I believe in the subtle politics of some of our great playwrights, the way they just lay down another story that is actually believing in caring for people. you know, in respecting our elders and taking care of them, in making sure that our kids have the best chance in life, that healthcare is available to people. And look, we're seeing that at the moment, that actually the fact that we've been clinging on by our fingernails to Medicare is paying off, because actually people are not, I'm talking to friends in New York, they're desperately afraid of getting sick because they don't have health insurance and they know they cannot afford to get this. Even if it's a slightly bad version and they have to go into hospital, they will be paying that off for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
You know, so the fear of getting sick is what's keeping people inside their houses. And I know people are afraid of getting sick here. They're not afraid that the hospital won't take care of them because they have no money.
So what would you say then, if we bought that now and said, you know, what would you say to the government in terms of theatres and the way that arts people are treated and the way that, you know, we are the theatre has been the hardest hit, and it's not just the people that are on stage, it's so many other jobs.
Look, yeah, anyone whose job has been destabilised is going through this at the moment. So I'm not suggesting that arts workers are alone, but the percentage of our industry that is actually without a way to feed itself at the moment is huge. Mm. You know, yes, we've lost 27% of our paid full-time jobs have been lost, but that doesn't even begin to address all of the arts workers who contract we work with workers. On a contract basis.
Yeah.
And so the fact that, you know, the 80% of our industry is on contract.
Yeah.
So 80% of our industry is without work.
They're these hidden people that you don't actually quite, they fall through the cracks.
Well, ironically, they're the most visible part of our community. Do you know what I mean? Our actors are struggling hugely because there is no work for them. You know, we can see them online. You know, we're doing readings online and things like that so that we can actually try and give small bits of money to people, because essentially they can't pay rent, they can't feed their families. And you go, and yes, what I want to say to the government is please give us JobKeeper for them, because they are our permanent working community. They work under contract, but they have been working under contract for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I would say any of the people that were contracted to us for our season should be considered our permanent staff. We don't have the resources to do that, to support them all with the funding that we have. And this, I'm speaking very specifically to Queensland Theatre situation. We're not eligible for JobKeeper because we're a statutory body. We're in a very fragile state at the moment. If this keeps going, essentially, at a certain point, we get to zero and we have no money. And the only way the company comes back is if the government then decides to invest money in the company. The more people that we can help in this way, the more people will be able to stay in the arts, as opposed to have to give up on it. We don't want to lose our artists to the feeling that they're absolutely not valued by government. They're going to need our theatres open and confidently telling stories. And if they need us to do that, they've got to support us through this crisis.
And you're listening to Stages, and I am talking with Lee Lewis, the Artistic Director of Queensland Theatre Company. So, Lee, what do you think our theatres do that nothing else does?
Well, it brings us together as a community on a given night to share a story that makes us question and sometimes agree on who we are and what we deeply believe in as a people. Mm-hmm. And it's so culturally specific, the decision to go and see that story on that given night. It binds us together. You look around a room of, you know, 350-odd other people, sometimes bigger, 800 people, and you go, all of you decided to do the same thing as me, and we all sit here. And at that moment when we all laugh at the same moment, or we all gasp at the same moment, we realize we belong to a society of people who think, if not exactly the same way, similarly. And how do we identify what our deep values are if not by coming together and breathing the same air, which is a really difficult thing to do at the moment. So the core thing that we do is the very thing that we're afraid of doing at the moment. And if we don't get back to doing it, we will lose a sense of who we are as a cultural nation.
As far back as I remember, you've been really strongly driven by the Australian voice and supporting works written, performed, obviously, by Australians. How do you think that voice has changed over the years?
Look, I think over the last 30 years, even 40 years, I think there's been a real questioning of what it, you know, you say Australian theatre, Australian play, We've questioned what is Australian, and that's been a changing thing. Like the picture, you know, the picture, the voice of Australian has changed. Like, you know, when Griffin started, it was with a group of rat bags who were working in the theatre, but actually weren't allowed to perform in their own voices because real theatre sounded British, which was essentially telling everybody sitting in the audience that that's where real culture came from. Mm. This bunch of rat bags said, no, actually, I want to perform a play in my own voice. And that was a radical act. And so writers started writing for our own voice. But that's only 50 years deep. And that was the first impulse to actually hear an Australian accent. So, you know, it took a little while, but then people started to go, you know what, the Australian accent isn't just that, you know, g'day, mate. Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's the sounds of all of the people from around the world that have come here and started to form it. So the Australian voice, what that looked and sounded like, you know, SBS started, and that was a radical act. Mm. That should be an Australian television station. You go, yeah, and the job that company has played in changing the vision of what Australia is in that thing of Australian and play has been huge, you know, and continues to be. You know, it's still a primary outreach mechanism to new arrivals in Australia who are looking to hear the sights and sounds of their homelands and connect with people here. So you kind of go, it's one of the most important spaces, creative spaces, that's been built over the last, you know, I don't know how old is SBS now? It must be going, you know. 35 years. So, but you know, now people take it for granted, and I go, that's great, but that's been a huge fight to get to the point where people should be able to take it for granted. And so I kind of go, so that's been a fascinating process.
But also the stories. What are those changing stories now that you've seen?
Actually, our value to the world is our ability to evolve what an Australian story is. So it's not about shutting out other stories. It's about letting that that spirit of openness, of welcome, which again has been under threat in the last chunk of the last 20 years, let that be a formative thought in Australia. And that becomes Australia's, you know, a great global experiment, really, about what it is for peoples of all the world to actually live in one space. It's different. It is different to the American thing, which is the melting pot. You all become American and you live the American dream. And like that American dream means actually leaving behind a large part of your identity and assimilating into or melting your identity into the pot. But the Australian one is actually, no, you can hold on to both. You can hold on to both, and that the next generation will be a strange and wonderful amalgam. And then the next generation after that will be, you know, a next step. And it's not about assimilation. It's about a growing together of different ideas. And how do we actually manage that? What is the freedom inside that for people to express themselves very differently? And how is that deeply Australian? And as we do that over generations, it's also that question of how do we then, as a nation of migrants, look at the origins of the culture, the dominant culture that we have now, and acknowledge that those are not great starts. And how do we be truthful about the origins of this country with our First Nations people, and acknowledge that we're all taking from a land that we haven't been given permission to come onto.
I think you've answered the question I was going to ask. Is do you think that there is a hole in the Australian story that we're not telling? But I think you've just answered that.
Absolutely. And I think that we'll the next 20 years is really that question of how do we really engage with truth telling about the origins of the strange Australia that has been created, and how do we acknowledge our First Nations people as central to the identity of Australia? How do we earn a relationship with our First Nations people, because we haven't earned it yet. And I think they've been more gracious than should possibly have ever been asked of humans, because we need to build the words to actually believe in and buy into the place beyond reconciliation, where we actually ask permission finally to be here.
I want to ask what prompted you, because you can make sort of, you know, Griffin is where a lot of your heart, it seems to be, is about that Australian voice and telling those stories. What prompted you to move north, the travel? Yes.
Look, it's complicated. And look, I was really conscious in watching companies around the world and artistic directors around the world. I was really conscious that if I stayed longer at Griffin, the company would start to be wrapped around my identity as opposed to me working for Griffin. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that actually in the long-term future of the company, it would only survive if it's allowed to change with time, with different people, and it builds up a robustness so that people know about Griffin as opposed to Lee Lewis mm-hmm. at Griffin. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, yeah. I felt like I could absolutely have stayed there for the rest of my life. It's a beautiful company. I love making work there. But then it becomes my company and it becomes hugely problematic in handing it on to the next generation. And I think we saw a little bit of that problem at Belvoir. Belvoir was so much Neil Armfield that when it was really hard for the audience to let go of the identity of work there and let it go into different and new places. I don't want to do that to Griffin because I think the function of the company is so important. It can't be dependent on one person. So hand it on. Mm. And at the same time, you know, I looked around at all the major performing arts companies and there are not a lot of female artistic directors. Going to go out on that limb. I don't think it's a limb that has not been acknowledged. And I was conscious that Griffin was an amazing opportunity for me to get the experience that I needed to, if I wanted to move up into a bigger company, that I kind of had a bit of an obligation, if I could, to at least have a crack at it and see what it was like to have another female artistic director voice at the level of the large companies in this country.
And there you are. Well, how is it now?
And then, hey, I was supposed to be moving, you know, going up to a big company. I was supposed to have, you know, resources, big theatres, money to spend, you know, development money. And, you know, I kind of go, you know, isn't it ironic? I get here and actually we're looking at, you know, if we open the theatre, we're only going to be able to have 80 to 100 people sitting in a theatre that sits 350 odd people. And so, you know, it was this funny thing where a beautiful executive director here, Amanda Jolly, says to me, how do we run the theatre if there are only 100 people in there? How can we afford to do that? I'm like, welcome to my world. I've been there for the last, you know, it's financially not feasible to, Griffin couldn't exist without extraordinary government support that is saying we believe that Australian stories are important enough to invest in. And that's what the government does. It invests a large amount of money at Griffin so that they can afford to do works for only 100 people. It's not a financially viable model. And that's what I know coming in here. No, it's not financially viable. But if the government wants us to open and open strong for audiences, then they need to support us to do that because there is no financial model that can make that work without the seat, without the tickets being $400 a piece, which means we're only making work for a very wealthy audience. And I don't believe that any of us want to see our theatre shut down to that kind of elitism.
No way.
So you've talked about how to survive sort of as a company, but how do you think it is, what do we need, what's important to survive as a creative?
You know, look, I have to say, and like a lot of creative people, I'm not feeling very creative at the moment. I'm kind of desperate and I'm worried and I'm afraid like most people. So I'm kind of that's the worst place to be creating from, I think. So what I'm doing is actually turning to really old school stuff. I'm just reading. But actually the creative space for me is actually sitting down and reading some of our great writers. And I'm going back to, you know, I'm looking at, I've found a lot of consolation in poetry and I've been reading those kinds of thoughts. And actually I'm enjoying reading on the page. I'm enjoying paper. I'm just trusting that if I read, well, look, I'm not a writer. What happens as a director is I read a play and that inspires me to make it. The play is the thing, you know, and it's, so what I trust is if I read, there'll be that thing in me that can't help it. Something will come from that. So I'm actually kind of embracing the time of just going, just read and trust that the inspiration will come from those other artists who've already done that work. Mm. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of Judith Wright's poetry. She's been quite a touchstone for me at various points in my life. And I actually hadn't realized how huge she is up in Queensland, that she lived a lot of her life up here. This is the Judith Wright Centre up here.
Yes.
And so it's this funny thing where I'm going, oh, hello, Judith, again. You know, I loved her when I was a teenager and I carried her to America with me for times when I was really homesick. And so it's this funny thing where I'm going, oh, hello, Judith, you're back in my life in a really funny way. And I'm kind of going, oh, and I'm finding, you know, and I can feel the stirring of a potential work built around her work. And I don't know if it'll turn into something, but I'm finding great solace in her writing at the moment. And I would say that to artists, like, you can't force the work. All you can do is be honest with where you're at the moment and try and take care of yourself. So that thing of going for walks, don't get trapped inside your room and don't come out, but in your bubble, mm-hmm. go for walks. You know, again, that thing of stay connected to people even when we can't. You know, make call up the people that you haven't talked to in 20 years and say, hey, are you okay? I've got a couple of friends I've reconnected with in America just by, you know, calling them up and going, hey, and they're like, oh my God, where are you? And I'm like, you know, so that sort of thing, just the humanness, somehow stay connected to humans. Don't drill down into the loneliness space that is actually happening at the moment.
Well, I think that's partly what theatre is, isn't it? It's about that humanness, about being beside each other, watching live people.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, theatre is one of our biggest tools for fighting loneliness.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're desperately needing at the moment, is that thing to come back online so that we don't feel quite as lonely.
Mm. So we will miss you down here in the New South Wales. You'll be back. What will you miss about Griffin?
Seriously, the intensity of work at Griffin. I absolutely will miss the Griffin audience. I love those people. They are the people who've made me the director that I am, by variously supporting different crazy ideas I've been able to try there. I mean, Kill Climate Deniers, ridiculous ridiculous idea of a play, but the audience decided that actually really worked for them, and that actually taught me a lot as a director. I'm looking forward to coming back and directing more at Griffin. You never leave Griffin. You never leave the place that gives you your start, and Griffin absolutely gave me my start, and I will go back and direct things. Oh, this is a pitch for work, Declan. I will come back and work for you in a heartbeat, just to have the chance to make work for that beautiful audience down there.
Well, thinking about it, it actually does seem a bit heart-shaped, the audience space.
Oh, you know, different people describe it in different ways. Mm. You know, like, I think Nick Marchant used to call it a jewel. Someone called it a coffin once, and I felt like slapping him. Sheridan Harbridge, Sheridan Harbridge called it the shape of my vagina. I'm like, okay, sure. You know, and I go, it's lovely, but I love that. It's heart-shaped. It is a little bit heart-shaped. Mm.
Well, Lee Lewis, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Regina. Pleasure has been all mine.
And that's Lee Lewis, taking solace in Judith Wright and staying connected any way possible until we can commune again in the cultural space of the theatre. She's the artistic director of Brisbane Theatre Company and an incredibly influential director of our times. Such a pleasure to have her. I'm Regina Botros. You've been listening to Stages from the home studio. Stay safe. I'll be back next week with more theatre. Thank you.